This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Marianne Faithfull has a new CD called Easy Come, Easy Go, on which she records cover versions of songs by other artists. It's her 22nd album, the latest in a career that began in the 1960s. Her first record was the 1964 hit As Tears Go By, written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones.
It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play. Smiling faces I can see, but not for me. I sit and watch as tears go by.
Faithfull was 17 when that record was released. At 18, she was married and became a mother. When she was 19, she began an affair with Mick Jagger and lived in the middle of the British Invasion celebrity party scene. But by 1970, she and Jagger had split up. By then, she had become addicted to heroin. At her low point, she lived on the street. She started recording again in the late 70s, and her voice was no longer the pure, innocent, uninflected voice of As Tears Go By. In the past couple of decades, she's been singing many original songs, as well as songs by Kurt Vile and others. Her new album of covers features her interpretations of everything from Randy Newman's In Germany Before the War to the Duke Ellington standard Solitude. Here's the opening track from her CD, Down from Dover, which was written by Dolly Parton.
I know this dress I'm wearing doesn't hide the secret I've tried concealing. When he left, he promised me that he'd be back by the time it was revealed. The sun behind a cloud just cast a crawling shadow o'er the fields of clover. And time is running out for me. I wish that he would hurry back from gone so long. When he left, the snow was deep upon the ground. And I have seen the spring and summer pass, and now the leaves are turning brown. And any time a tiny face will show itself, 'cause wedding's almost over. But I won't have a name to give it if he doesn't hurry back from Dover.
That's music from the new Marianne Faithfull recording, Easy Come, Easy Go. Terry spoke with Marianne Faithfull twice, in 1994 and 2005. We'll start with their conversation from 2005.
Your voice is very different from the way it was at the start of your career.
Well, obviously. Mine was always, you know, I studied singing at school when I was young. And my singing teacher used to say to me in hushed tones, you know, you have a soprano now, but I think if you're very, very lucky, it will become a contralto.
Why did your teacher think that that would be good luck if it
did? Well, it's a very rare thing to have. It's Kathleen Ferrier. You know, there are very few real contraltos. And I'm one of them.
I don't know what you'll make of this, but I think of you as being similar to Billie Holiday and Lottie Lenya, as great singers whose voices were very different at the beginning and end of their careers.
Of course. But that's partly technical, like I told you. But it's also experience. It's... In my case, I mean, thank you very much for comparing me in any way with my great heroines, Billie Holiday and Lotte Lenya. But in my case, and I'm sure in their case, you know, a lot of it is down to experience. You get the voice you really want. You get what I suppose a writer would call it, finding my voice.
was there anything that you missed about that pure soprano that you had? You know, the high notes or that...
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, if I hadn't been discovered by Andrew Oldham and gone into the pop business, I would have probably either become an actress or I might have gone to the Royal Academy of Music in London and I could have sung Mozart. I would have enjoyed that. But on the other hand, you know, I kind of... it was very exciting to be in at the beginning of a new thing, which is what was happening in London in the early 60s. And I was right there.
You know, it's interesting, like As Tears Go By, which is your famous first hit, you're singing in an almost uninflected voice.
That's what Andrew wanted.
That's what he wanted. Why? This is Andrew Luke Oldham, who was your producer, and he was the Rolling Stones producer.
He was my manager.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. And I suppose he was the producer, too, yeah.
So why did he want it uninflected?
I don't know. I think he wanted me to sound like Mick.
Huh.
I really don't know. You'd have to ask Andrew.
It's so interesting because there's so much drama in your singing now.
Well, yeah, but that's my natural thing. Maybe I didn't have that yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned that...
I was only 17.
Right, right.
I don't think I had any.
Any drama?
No, and I was terribly, terribly nervous. So probably the natural thing I did was just sort of do what I do when I'm very frightened, is pretend I'm very small and stay very still and do as little as possible.
Now, you mentioned that La Dolena is one of your music heroes.
Mm.
So I thought maybe we could listen to a recording in which you sing Kurt Vile.
Mm.
And you made a recording. You've done a lot of Kurt Vile.
I've done
years.
Two records of the Brecht Vile canon. The first one was the Cabaret record, which was 20th Century Blues, which I love. But my actual total favorite of all time is the Seven Deadly Sins. But play something from 20th Century Blues. Play Pirate Jenny. I like Pirate Jenny because it's so fierce.
And Paul Trueblood is at the piano, and he sounds
Paul
great
Trueblood
with you.
Is such a great musician, and I was so lucky to work with him, and I'm very fond of him.
Well, let's go for the drama and hear Pirate Jenny. And this is from Marianne Faithfull's album 20th Century Blues with Paul Trueblood at the piano.
You lads see me wash the glasses, wipe the floors, make the beds. I'm the best of servants. You can kindly throw me pennies and I thank you very much. And you see me ragged and tattered in this dirty hotel. You don't know in hell who's talking. You still don't know in hell who's talking. Yet one fine day there will be roars from the harbour, and you'll ask what is all that screeching for. And you'll see me smiling as I dunk the glasses, and you'll say, what's she got to smile at for? And the ship, eight sails shining, 55 cannons wide, sir, waits there at the quay. You say, work on, wipe the glasses, my girl, and just slip me a dirty...
Marianne Faithfull, how were you introduced to the music of Kurt Vile?
Well, I sort of grew up with it, you know. Both my parents... I don't know how they did it. I don't know how my mother did this. But she brought 78s with her from Vienna. And a lot of the songs on 20th Century Blues are my mother's favourite songs or my father's favourite songs. Like, my father's favourite song was Falling in Love Again.
Huh.
And he loved Cole Porter and he loved all sorts of things like that. Yeah.
So is that like the first music you heard?
I suppose it is, yes. Yeah.
Was your mother a singer? I had read that she...
No.
No?
My mother was a dancer.
Oh.
She was very young, of course, and she was only 24 when Mr. Hitler marched into Vienna in the Anschluss, but she was a dancer in Berlin. And she, as she would be coming into the theatre to rehearse as the corps de ballet for Mr. Reinhardt, would see Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht staggering out in the morning, having been up all night writing the Threepney Opera. And they would all bob a little curtsy and say, "Guten Morgen, Mr. Weill. Guten Morgen, Mr. Brecht."
When you were growing up, did she have, like, clothes from her costumes from when she danced in the closet?
Not much, no. I just have a very beautiful piece of chiffon and some beads. I have very little. She didn't bring any of that much with her. No, I don't know what happened to it. It's as if she wanted to leave it all behind and have a new life. She'd had quite a hard time, I think, during the war. My grandmother was Jewish, you know, and she met my father was a spy. I mean, it's so incredible, it's amazing. And she was his contact in Vienna. So it was really, I think she was really happy to marry my father and get out. Unfortunately, of course, the marriage was a disaster. But
well, I think they separated when you were six or something, right?
Yes.
And then you lived with your mother.
I did, yes.
At what point did you start getting to know the, and I assume that you did at some point, the Andy Warhol factory crew?
I didn't.
You never knew them?
No, I never did.
It just seems to me you'd have connected at some point.
Never. Never, 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 never. I went to New York once with Andrew. And what I did do was meet up with Al Grossman and Bobby Newhouse. And it was the time when Bob Dylan had had his motorbike accident. And I think I had my first joint with Bobby Newhouse. And I was up all night being sick.
From the joint?
Mm-hmm. I was 18.
Right. Just
wasn't able, didn't know anything. Just couldn't deal with it.
So, you know, I'm wondering what you thought, because you must have been aware of this, whether you knew the Velvet Underground personally or not.
Oh, I thought they were wonderful.
Yeah.
But I had a sense of self-preservation, which told me, do not go to New York. You will die.
Right, because you'd get so deep into it.
It would have been another Edie Sedgwick. You know, it was quite bad enough in London, if I may say so. But, I mean, it would have been too much for me.
What did you make of it when the Velvet Underground recorded Venus and Furs?
And I didn't really think about it.
I ask this in case our listeners are confused. My
great-great-uncle,
yes,
was Baron Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, who gave his name to masochism and wrote a book called Venus and Furs. Yeah, I mean, I sort of noticed it, but didn't really notice it. There were other songs on the Velvet Underground that I thought were better. I didn't think that was one of the best. I'm a huge, and was always a huge fan of Andy Warhol. I mean, before I got discovered and all that stuff happened, my mother took me to see a huge Andy Warhol retrospective at the Tate. I went to see the Picasso retrospective. I went to see the Surrealist retrospective. It was wonderful, you know. I had a wonderful life before all that stuff happened.
Marianne Faithfull has a new CD, Easy Come, Easy Go. Terry also spoke to Marianne Faithfull in 1994 after the publication of her autobiography. It told about her music career, her affair with Mick Jagger, and the heroin addiction that nearly killed her. During their earlier conversation, Terry asked Marianne Faithfull how she met Mick Jagger.
So tell us the story of how you met Mick Jagger.
Well, I went along to a party with my first boyfriend, John Dunbar, who was a friend of Peter and Gordon. And Paul McCartney was going out with Jane Asher. It's so hard to remember all these things. And somehow, John was always up for a party. And especially then, when we were very young. I mean, I was 17. And he must have been 19, you know, 19, 20, no more. But, you know, it was just a party. But it was a dead glam party, I suppose, even for London. And it was a lot of fun, I suppose, yes.
In your memoir, you reprint a press release that was written for when As Tears Go By was released. And it says, Marianne Faithfull is the little 17-year-old blonde who still attends a convent in Reading, daughter of the Baroness Orisso. She is lissome and lovely with long blonde hair.
Lots of alliteration in this press release, yeah. Isn't there? Yes.
A shy smile and a liking for people who are long-haired and socially conscious. Marianne digs Marlon Brando, Woodbine cigarettes, poetry, going to the ballet, and wearing long evening dresses. She is shy, wistful, waif-like. Now, what did you think of that image of yourself?
I thought it was a hoot. I remember taking it back to my mum and sitting in Milman Road reading it to my mother and Chris, my brother. We just fell about laughing, you know. I never in my wildest dreams thought that people would think I was like that. Although I did dig Marlon Brando. That's true. And I was at a convent. And my mother was a baroness. But apart from that... But then again... You know, I can't be too sort of sticky about this because it's quite obvious that none of us really see ourselves as others see us.
Now you ended up doing a lot of drugs, doing a lot of heroin. How did you start doing heroin?
I used it as a coping mechanism, I think.
For coping with what?
For coping with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked for a while, but it did have a tremendous drawback, which was that it was addictive and it would kill you.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
Ages. Very long time. But I did figure it out eventually, thank God.
Now, I want to play a song that you wrote the lyrics for called Sister Morphine. That was released in England in 1969. Tell me a little bit about where you were in your life when you wrote the song and what the lyrics are about.
I don't know. It's a very weird thing about Sister Morphine because, you know, it was knocking about the house for 6 months. And Mick was playing it all the time.
Playing the melody.
Playing the basic thing. Da, 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 that thing all the time. So it went into my sort of whole sort of nervous system, blood, burns, whatever, everything. I really had it in my I knew it by heart, let's say that anyway. And then I remember it, and I'm sure Mick does too. It was very peculiar. I just sat down, picked up a legal pad and a pencil and wrote it out, you know. And there it was. But I do that sometimes. It's obvious. I work on it in my head. And then when it's all ready, I do it.
Why don't we hear Sister Morphine? This is Marianne Faithfull, recorded in 1969. Marianne Faithfull is my guest, and she's written an autobiography called Faithfull. The record company, Decca, you say yanked this record about 2 days after it was released.
Took it off the shelves.
What was their objection?
Well, there were many. The lyrics were very ahead of their time. It's one thing for Lou Reed to sing heroin, obviously. It was completely... This is something I really didn't understand, that this thing about me being this beautiful little angel was real. I never really believed that. I couldn't believe it. So I suppose for Decca, you know, the last thing they put out by Marianne Faithfull, I can't remember what it was Summer Nights, say. I think it was. That was in 1965. And then in 1969, they're given Sister Morphine. And they couldn't handle it.
Marianne Faithfull, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Marianne Faithfull speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Marianne Faithfull's new CD, Easy Come, Easy Go, has just been released. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The latest entry in the late-night TV talk show wars arrived on NBC with a lot of big names, not the least of which was the exciting, innovative house band.
From Studio 6B in Rockefeller Center, the National Broadcasting Company presents Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Tonight's guests are Robert De Niro, Justin Timberlake, musical guest Van Morrison, and featuring the legendary Roots crew.
In the world of hip-hop, where most music is sampled, the Roots are exceptional. They play instruments, everything from electric guitar to tuba. And on TV, they're a lot more entertaining and more prominent than your everyday or every night house band. Last night on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy gave the Roots a chance to show off its improv skills.
We're fortunate to have the greatest band in Late Night with us, the Roots. Please give it up for the Roots, everybody. I love you guys. You guys are amazing. You can play any type of music, right?
Yeah, you know, you name it, we can do it.
All right, well, great. Let's play with that a little bit. What if I pick someone from the audience and we'll see if the Roots can make up a song about the person in the audience? Is that cool? Are you ready?
Yeah, we're ready. Yeah.
How about you guys? You guys ready? Let's do it. All right, let's zoom in. How about, yeah, zoom in with the red hair. Yeah, you look perfect. What's your name?
Jenny.
Okay, Jenny. This is all helping our tune. What's your favorite color?
Purple.
You're not making it easy on them at all, are you? It's going to rhyme with purple. Where are you from?
Hartville, Ohio.
Hartville, Ohio. All right, Roots, here's the deal. We got Jenny. She's from Hartfield, Ohio. This is not easy. All right, she's a Hartfield, and she loves the color purple. Let's see what happens.
Love Geek Chic, he got the nerdy lock. We finish in the second week here at 30 Rock. My man Jimmy, yeah, I know you heard he hot. How he matches his ties up with whatever shirt he got. Speaking of colors, on shows we got many. Just like purple, that's the favorite color of Jenny. Word, when I spit rhymes, you know the thought ill. So take that song back to your people in hearts.
Our next guest, Questlove, is the co-founder and drummer of The Roots. Terry spoke with him in 2003. Questlove, also known as Amir Thompson, grew up in Philadelphia around music. His father, Lee Andrews, led the doo-wop group Lee Andrews and the Hearts, which had the hit single Teardrops. Questlove co-founded The Roots in 1987 when he was a student at the Philadelphia High School for Creative and Performing Arts. That was back when sampling, not live drumming, provided most of the beats in hip-hop music.
Coming up in high school, when the Roots first started, you know, hip-hop really wasn't that elaborate an arrangement. I'm talking about hip-hop circa 1984, 85, 86. I mean, it's pretty much just a drum beat, a simple drum beat, and a stab. A stab would be sort of like the exclamation point at the end of a sentence. Bam! You know, it could be scratched in or just like some sort of noise, mm-hmm. an enforcement noise. And, you know, so in high school, pretty much Black Thought, Tariq Trotter would, you know, come up to me and just name any popular song at that time and point and just say, yo, play Top Billing. And, you know, because it was a drum arrangement, I knew how to play it. And that was like the most amazing thing to him. He could play Top Billing. He could play... You know, The Bridge Is Over, he could play, just naming all these songs and I could play them. I kind of thought it was natural.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop you right there because that's kind of interesting. Since you came up in the era of sampling, as an actual musician, your friends mm-hmm. expected you to basically play the samples. You're still expected
yeah, exactly.
to play, but you're still expected to play like other people's music.
Right. Well, I mean, that's hip hop is audio pop art, really. It's just a collage of other ideas. And even at the time, I didn't know that, okay, sampling is the proper term for it. For the Hip Hop Nation, pretty much the first introduction to real sampling that we've ever seen was this episode of The Cosby Show when Stevie Wonder runs over the Huxtables' car with his limousine. Well, not that violent, but, you know, he invites them to a studio session. And for the first time, America got to see the process of sampling, in which you say something and it's repeated back to you. And after me and my friend saw that episode, we were begging for whatever that machine was called. We didn't know what it was called. You know, like in our heads, it was sort of like the Flintstone episode where, you know, like the little bird is inside of the machine and recreating the noise. And we didn't know how in the world that happened. So just during Christmas, Casio happened to make a product called an SK1 machine, which allowed you about maybe 3 or 4 seconds worth of sampling time. And, you know, me and all my friends got this little toy keyboard for Christmas. And, you know, you mess around with it a little while. You do, like, all the curse words, you know, and all that stuff. And then you start getting serious about it. And that's when I would, like, run to the basement where my drum set was and try and cram in 8 bars worth of drum breaks within 3 seconds, which, you know, you have to be pretty fast to do it.
Right.
And then I just, you know, realized the endless possibilities of a sampler, you know.
You started playing drums when you were in high school, yes?
No, actually
earlier
I started when I was 2.
Oh, okay.
I was 2 years old. I started the Roots when I was in high school. My father is an oldies doo-wop singer from the Philadelphia area.
Leandra's of Leandra's and the Hearts.
Yeah, Leandra's and the Hearts. So I pretty much, my childhood is... It's pretty much based just backstage at doo-wop extravaganza shows, you know, like Dick Clark Presents, you know, and there would be like 10 groups, Don and Wine, Harvey and the Moonglows, The Tokens, you name it. If they were from the 50s or the 60s, it would just be a big show at either like Madison Square Garden or the Spectrum or out in the Forum in L.A., so pretty much that's I grew up backstage.
No,
watching all these groups.
Leandra's biggest hit, I think, was Teardrops in 1957.
Teardrops.
Yeah.
57. Yeah, 57.
Would you be willing to sing a few lines from it just to refresh listeners' memories?
I wouldn't want to scare your listeners, so.
Okay. Well, how about this? How about we play a little bit of it?
We can do that. Yeah.
I sit in my room, looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I'm thinking of our lost romance and how it should have been. Oh, if we only could start over again. Out on you, I was wrong to take a chance with somebody new. I sit in my room, looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I know you never.
Okay, so that's Leandra's and the Hearts. So you grew up, you know, backstage and watching your father perform. What sense did it give you of what the music life was like? And then you probably watched your father kind of drop out of sight after the doo-wop era was over. So you also knew what it was like to no longer be in the limelight after having been in it as a young man.
I mean, I was born in the 70s, so pretty much I came along.
Oh, you came along
it really wasn't about it. I mean, even though he made it a career, if anything, he taught me that there is a plan B, you know, and that not everyone gets the plan A limelight.
Right. What was his
plan
B?
By the time I was born, you know, he had met and married my mother. I have a sister as well, and they had opened up a boutique store and they were quite content. And, you know, as with any music phenomenon that occurs 20 years before, there's an upsurgence of it 20 years later. And I guess most of that started when Sha Na Na appearing at Woodstock, and then pretty much after that, just Dick Clark would throw a slew of shows just in the tri-state area, in the New York area, any place that loved doo-wop. Mm-hmm. And my father just made a great living out of it. And
don't you often wonder if there's going to be, like, old-school rap shows? Like,
oh, there is right now.
Is there already?
Totally. And the thing with hip-hop is the motto for hip-hop is definitely here today and gone today. So
yeah, I know what you mean.
Anything under 5 years is pretty much considered old school. This weekend, I was listening to a popular New York radio station, and they were like, "Now, back in the day, Wu-Tang Clan, da-da-da-da, old school." I was like, "Wait a minute, Wu-Tang? That's 6 years ago."
Right.
It's like 6-7 years ago. You know, old school to me is, okay, maybe we can say, like, Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On, like a song that's definitely over 20 years old or something, you know, near 30 years old. But, yeah, pretty much in the hip-hop, it's here today and it's gone today.
Let's get back to your high school years. And you went to the High School of Creative and Performing Arts.
Performing Arts, right.
In Philadelphia. Yes. And so that means that you were exposed at a young age to artists of your age, of every sort.
Exactly.
You know painters and dancers and people in theater.
Everything.
And music of
Boys
every
to
sort.
Boys to Men rehearsing in the...
Boys to Men was in your school?
In the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Always rehearsing.
Was it good to be exposed to so much?
It was perfect. You know, like, my first... I actually, unfortunately, I came to Performing Arts High School in the 11th grade. I started, Performing Arts had a private school sector that I went to from first to eighth grade. Then my parents took me out of that school and tried to send me to a college prep school, which was good academic. You know, I could wind up on Jeopardy, you know, you know, talk about the Iliad or something. But, you know, my heart was with music development. And so I begged them to send me to the public school for performing arts, and finally got my wish for the 11th and 12th grade. And walking there, like, I'd never been to public school, and pretty much my only exposure to that type of school was watching the television show Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're kind of wondering, like, okay, is this the type of school that's going to be, like, a cliche? Like, are they going to break out and dance numbers in the hallway and you know, do all the things that you see on television? And, you know, I was, like, real skeptical of it. Like, it's not going to be, like, Fame or whatever. And sure enough, like, you walk into class and, you know, they're singing, you know, Boyz II Men's practicing in the corner. And you have, like, Krista McBride and Joey DeFrancesco trading fours down the hallway.
Wait, these are now well-known jazz musicians.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, like, the who's who of, like, the thespian world rehearsing, you know, their sonnets over there. And it's crazy. It was really a weird experience for me.
Now, the roots are from Philly. And for a lot of rappers, like, the place they're from becomes, like, mythologized through their raps.
Right.
What do you think you've done, like, to create a Philadelphia in your music?
Well, Philadelphia had sort of a bad/nondescript reputation between...
In hip-hop, you mean? Because there was the Philly sound before that.
Yeah, I'm just talking in terms of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm,
even
right.
though... Even though I'll say two of the major important factors of hip hop history have originated in Philadelphia. Number one, gangster rap. Pretty much, there's debate as to whether Ice-T, LA, who's from LA, or Schoolie D, who's from 52nd and Parkside, was the first quote unquote gangster rapper. And pretty much anybody that's familiar with Schooly D can give you pretty much an account of where they were the first time they ever heard his classic, PSK, What Does It Mean? You know, because we just never heard a rap that explicit. You know, pretty much hip-hop before then was about partying. And, you know, there were some reality rhymes here and there. You know, the message by Grandmaster Flash and Maybe It's Like mm-hmm. That by Run DMC. But, you know, pretty much everyone's been, like, politically correct. You didn't hear that much profanity, that much cursing, and that much honesty. You know, Schooly D talked like your older cousin on the corner, you know, or the guys that you knew down the street on the corner. And, you know, he was very influential to a lot of right. of people, the Beastie Boys, and the list goes on.
So what's and your also, yeah what's your image of Philly in your music?
Well we had to take that, and well let me just quickly say that the other important element was the art of DJing. Philadelphia has four very important pioneers in DJing: Jazzy Jeff, DJ Cash Money, DJ Miz, and DJ Cheese, all from the tri-state area. And they're pretty much the standard for which DJs today are basing their skills on. When you talk about DJs doing the look mono hand tricks and whatnot. So pretty much that's all that Philly, those were the two major factors that Philly offered in the 80s. And, you know, living under New York's shadow didn't help matters much because, you know, they were the creme de la creme of right. culture.
One last thing. I'm interested in your record collection. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand you have a really big one. What's the range of things that you listen to?
Anything. I'm just into anything musical. You know, I like the incredible Bongo Rock group. I like David Bowie. I like, you know, I collect a lot of rare hip hop records, and I collect just a lot of obscure records that have been used in samples. I'm very curious in the ingredients that other producers have used to make their records, you know. It's sort of like someone going out and buying a cookbook to see the ingredients that went right. inside of a right. particular stew. So I collect those type of things.
Do you collect a lot of vinyl?
Yeah, I'm about 27,000 strong right now.
A vinyl?
I know that's not messing with DJ Shadow's collection. I heard he's up to 60,000.
Wow, so, it's mighty impressive, though.
I got some ways to go, but yeah, I'll get there.
Okay, and one final question.
Yes.
How come you wear an afro?
Because I'm secretly a Chia Pet.
I won't sing the theme.
right.
Yeah.
My hair just grows. I come from a family that, you know, I don't have the patience nor the time to go to a barbershop and get it cut every 3 seconds. So my hair just grows. It's always been problematic for me. Just thank God it's in style now. Imagine me trying to get through this hairstyle in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know. Back then I could do a flat top thing, but no, I keep it. It's my crown, you know. It's sort of symbolic now, but yeah, it was a problem back in the day. You know, people staring at me like, oh, my God. You know, now it's no thing because everyone has it.
Oh, besides you're you, so
yeah, exactly.
You can do it now.
I'm an individual.
That's right. Thank
or
you so
of the
much.
Missing Jacksons.
Oh, thank
All right, thank you.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Tara.
Amir Thompson, a.k.a. Questlove, speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. His band, The Roots, is now on TV every weeknight as the house band on NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Here's a track from the latest CD by The Roots, Rising Down.
Monday they predict the storm. Tuesday they predict the rain. Wednesday they cover because of what it was. I did what I did because it does what it does. I don't put nothing above what I am, what I love. My family, my blood, my city and my hood. Hater for the greater good. I'm back from Hollywood and I ain't changed a lick. Though I know I probably should, but what I'm doing is not a good look. I never did it by the good book. As a lifetime crook, all the petty crime took a toll on me. I look around at my homies, it's getting old on me. But still something got a hold on me. Maybe it's fake. If it's coming, yo, I'm willing to wait. I'm not running, I done ran through the muck. I done scrambled and such. I done robbed and odd jobs and gambled enough. Till I'm put up in handcuffs and pissing in a cup. If it's a guy, I don't know if he listening or what.
The 77-year-old Swedish filmmaker Jan Troll is best known in the U.S. for his pair of 1970s epics, The Emigrants and The New Land. His latest film is Maria Larsson's Everlasting Moments, a title shortened in this country to Everlasting Moments. It will open in select cities over the next month and can also be seen on pay-per-view cable. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
It's easy to see why Ingmar Bergman, and not his countryman Jan Troll, gets all the love when academics talk about late 20th century world cinema. Bergman, a student of 19th century philosophy and theater, loads his dramas with metaphysical baggage, whereas Troll's characters appear to be unencumbered by anything except daily life. But every frame of Troll's entrancingly beautiful new movie, Everlasting Moments, uses surfaces, light, texture, faces, to hint at another world, a shadow realm. And if that sounds fancy, the film itself is deceptively simple, delicate, evenly paced, straight ahead. The metaphor is right there in the story, which centers on a turn-of-the-century woman who finds an old camera in a cabinet and discovers that she has what another character calls a gift for seeing. She's Maria, and she's played by Maria Heiskanen, an actress who can seem plain and mousy in one instant and radiantly inquisitive the next. A Finnish immigrant to Sweden, Maria marries her husband, Sig, played by Michael Persbrandt, in 1907, and has a boatload of kids. And the film charts their marriage in a leisurely, episodic way, through births and deaths and tumultuous strikes and a world war. The narrator is Maria's eldest daughter, Maya, who watches from the sidelines as her father comes home roaring drunk and abusive, then swears off drink and joins the Temperance Society, then falls off the wagon and takes up with a barmaid. Sig is not a bad man, but a weak one, a creature of appetite who never thinks twice about exploiting his male authority. And Maria is trapped in his world, burdened with her children's care, unable to earn a living on her own. That's when she comes on that camera, which she'd won in a lottery before she was married. And in the course of trying to hawk it, she meets a camera shop owner named Pedersen, who's obviously smitten. He pushes her to use the thing. Nowadays, we hold up our phones and snap a shot and send it across the world. But Everlasting Moments unfolds in an age in which the art and science of photography is still in its infancy and carries, especially for someone like Maria, a whiff of magic. Pedersen demonstrates how the camera works. He catches on the photographic plate the shadow of a fluttering bird, and there's that other realm in which something fleeting and specific becomes lasting and universal. Maria begins to develop a dual self. As a photographer, she can forget for an instant she's tied to the role of wife and mother, yet her powers as an artist are tied to the generosity of her spirit. When a young girl drowns, she asks the mother if she can photograph the body, and the image she produces seems to hold the child's very soul. I'm afraid that makes Everlasting Moments sound fuzzy and sentimental, but it's the simplicity and directness of the dead child's photo that gives the image weight. The whole movie is like that. There isn't a shot that looks like something you've seen before. Troll treats every frame as if the medium of filmmaking was new and precious. Period films with lots of sepia tones are usually soft in the head, but the nostalgic glow of Everlasting Moments somehow underscores the clarity of its vision. Images of the young Maya on the cobbled street as she waits for her father, of her disheartened friend Ingeborg striding out into the middle of a frozen lake and disappearing into the fog, of small children gathered in a window frame trying to glimpse a dead body. They suggest at once the ephemeral and the indelible. In Troll's miraculous vision, that's not a contradiction.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Fairby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hersfeld. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.